I wrote the book because it's about old technologies, simple technologies that people will think are something they can understand. A telegraph is just dots and dashes. A light bulb is heating up a wire. And I'm showing how those technologies shaped us. So if we can look at the past, we're better prepared to look at technologies in the future.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum, coming to you via Zoom. I'm Mary Stack, and today I'm delighted to bring you a new book written by a wonderfully clever and engaging woman. Anisa Ramirez, today's guest, is author of The Alchemy of Us, How Humans and Matter Transformed One Another. Before she explains why she wrote the book and a little bit about what's in it, let me give you a brief bio. Ramirez is an accomplished material scientist and science writer with a passionate zeal for her subject. She's a graduate of both Brown and Stanford. She's worked as a research scientist at Bell Labs and has held teaching posts at both Yale and MIT. So tell us a bit about the book.
Sure. The idea for how to write about material science came to me a couple of years ago by accident. I was taking a couple of glassblowing classes to check it off my bucket list. And in that class, that's when this idea came to me. Now, I'll just keep it short, but suffice it to say, I went to glassblowing class in a bad mood. It was an accident. Nobody got hurt. But afterwards, I started thinking about how I actually felt like I was in a better mood. Well, what had happened? I was shaping the glass, and the glass was actually shaping me. And so this moment made me think, I wonder how materials and matter have been in a dance with each other in the past and how they've shaped each other. It was that glass-blowing accident that actually compelled me to look at how materials and humans have been interacting with each other, have been transforming each other over the course of generations. So what I would like to do is share with you a little bit about how I went about talking about how technology has shaped us. I decided to take a different approach. In my first chapter, I wanted to talk about how obsessed we became with time, as our timepieces became better and better and more precise, made possible by the materials inside. I wanted to say, we as a society became obsessed with time. And I could have wrote down, we became obsessed with time. That probably would have been a very short sentence. But what I decided to do is let Ruth Belville show you how obsessed with time we became. Ruth Belville was a woman who lived in England. She lived in the 19th century, and she had an unusual job. She sold time. Yep, I said that right. She sold time. She would leave her house in Maidenhead, make her way over to London, then make her way over to Greenwich, and then walk up a steep hill to the Royal Observatory. And it's there, she was carrying her pocket watch, that she would give it to the attendant and have it compared to their main clock. They'd give her a certificate, letting her know the difference between their time and her time. Then she'd make her way down the hill and then over to London, and then give her watch to various businesses that needed to know it. Ruth was called the Greenwich Time Lady. Now, I could have said how obsessed with time we were, but this woman having the ability to have a business based on selling time makes that a little bit more clear. So I took an approach of telling stories to share, to get across my point. Another thing, I wanted to also talk about how technology sometimes goes awry. And I could have wrote down, technology goes awry. That would have been a very short sentence. But what I decided to do is let Caroline Hunter and Ken Williams show you how technology goes awry. Caroline Hunter and Ken Williams were employees of Polaroid in the early 70s. And they found out that their employer, which had made this fantastic technology of camera film that could be processed instantly, was actually selling their product to South Africa. South Africa at the time was under an apartheid government. And it ends up that black citizens had to carry a passbook, which monitored where they were going and also controlled where they were going. At the heart of the passbook was a picture made by Polaroid. Now, Caroline Hunter and Ken Williams weren't happy about this. And so they knew that this was not what they should be doing. The government, the UN, had said that America should not be interacting with South Africa. And so they went and did something about it. They knew firsthand about the impact of technology and how sometimes something that's beloved, like instant photography, can actually be sent in a different direction. So I used storytelling in showing how technology was part of our lives, in putting it in a cultural setting. Okay, so let's dive into how technology has actually shaped us. What I want to do is I want to share with you how technology can lead to a surprise and how sometimes technology can generate an unintended consequence. Let's start off with a surprise. If I wanted to think about a case study for something that can lead to a surprise, that would actually be the telegraph. I know it's old technology, but it actually had tremendous impact on us. How did it do so? Well, let me give you the backstory first. Samuel F.B. Morse was a painter. He wasn't an inventor, and he would have loved to have had a telegraph earlier in his life. His invention came from tragedy. He was away from home, and he got news by mail, which is the fastest way that information could travel, that his wife had died. And had he gotten information sooner, he could have rushed to be by her side, but that didn't happen. So he went on to build an invention so that other people wouldn't suffer the way that he did. Now, years later, as he was developing his telegraph, he would experiment with his assistant, Alfred Vail, and something started to bubble up in the process. As they were doing experiments where they would write things by hand, translate them into dots and dashes, and then transmit them, and then get the dots and dashes, and then convert those into words, Morse was actually starting to get a little annoyed with Vail. He would write to Vail, "Condense your language." He was telling Vail, "Stop using words that don't contribute to the meaning of the word." He would get a transmission. Let's say, for instance, he would get dash, four dots, and then another dot. And then he would translate it. And it was the word the. That's a lot of work for a word that really doesn't contribute much to the meaning. So this is why he chided Vail to condense your language. Now, decades later, the telegraph became part of American life. And telegraph officers would tell customers, "Look, you're happy to use this, but you have to be brief." The telegraph was great at shuttling information rapidly, but it had a limitation. It could only handle a certain number of messages at one time. So the telegraph officer told customers that they had to be brief so that they didn't tie up the line, so that it remained available. The telegraph also became part of newspapers. Newspapers enjoyed sending messages across the country very rapidly, and editors would tell the reporters that we want you to write your reports, but you have to be succinct, again, because of the limitation of the telegraph. Well, one writer really loved this style of writing with short declarative sentences, and he went on to be an author that we know today as Ernest Hemingway. So you can see this technology of the telegraph, which was designed to send information rapidly, because of its limitation, actually gave rise to the shaping of language as well. Now, there were many other factors that shaped American English, but one of them was a technology, and that technology was the telegraph. So that's a case of how a technology can give rise to a surprising outcome. Let's explore how a technology can give rise to unintended consequences. A case study for that is the light bulb. Yep, the simple light bulb. Now, when you think about the inventor of the light bulb, you think about Edison. But let's suffice it to say that he was interested in pushing back the darkness and lengthening the day. That was his intention for creating the light bulbs. But now it's changing our world because there's an abundance of light. How is it changing the world? Well, it's changing the natural world. I can tell you that fireflies aren't too happy about the abundance of lights. Why is it? Well, because fireflies, they talk to each other with flashes of light, and it's dependent on their ability to see each other. But the overhead lights are making it that it's hard for them to see each other, it's hard for them to meet, and no future fireflies. So their numbers actually decreasing. One of the reasons is because of the abundance of lights. So that's a sad situation, that we actually have species that are being impacted. But fireflies are not the only species that are being impacted by the lights. We are. It ends up that humans are actually two organisms. We have a daytime mode and a nighttime mode. In our daytime mode, we have an increase in metabolism, temperature, and growth hormone. And in the nighttime mode, all of those numbers decrease. How the body knows if it should be daytime or nighttime depends on the lights. Now, in order to understand this, we actually have to think about our eye. As you know, our eye helps us see. Light goes to the retina, which goes down through the optic nerve, to the brain, where that information is reassembled as vision. But recently, and by recently, I mean in the last 30 years, we have found that the eye has another role that we did not know about. Yeah, it has a photoreceptor, which does not contribute to vision. It's detecting blue light. When it sees the blue light, it goes down the optic nerve to the brain, and it goes to another part of the brain, which stops secreting melatonin. Melatonin is a chemical compound which tells all the cells in the body that it's nighttime mode, to be in rest mode. When the light is detected, blue light is detected, the melatonin is shut off, and so we enter into daytime mode. So in short, blue light, daytime mode. Now, long ago, when our ancestors were alive, they lived by sunlight, and then they lived by candlelight. The sun has a lot of blue in it, so they were in daytime mode. And as the sun set and they were under candlelight, which is red, they entered into nighttime mode. But we are living constantly under artificial lights, which are very strong in the blue. So we are in that growth mode all the time until we go to sleep. And you may be asking, well, what's the big deal? Well, it ends up that the change is already perceivable of being underneath those artificial lights. Scientists have said that we are taller than our ancestors. Now, sure, there's many factors that contribute to that. Nutrition, water, medicine. But another factor is artificial lights. And the reason being because our body is swimming in growth hormone, and so the cells will respond to that overstimulation. But sometimes the cells will respond in a way that's in a negative way. Epidemiologists have found that there's a certain population of people that have an increase in risk in certain diseases, including some forms of cancer. And the reason being the work that they do. They work at night underneath the electric lights. So you see, Edison had created a technology to push back the night and to lengthen the day, but there's this unintended consequence that's come about. There's this new challenge of how do we live healthily underneath the lights? Well, it ends up that the prescription to live underneath the lights is actually pretty straightforward. What we need are bright mornings and dim evenings. We need blue light in the morning, and then we need less blue or redder light in the evening. We can get blue light from the sun. The sun has blue light, so we can go for a walk. The other option is that you can use blue LEDs or compact fluorescent bulbs, which are rich in blue. Now, as the sun sets, what we need to do is actually change the type of light. The light needs to be redder. So red LEDs or incandescent bulbs will help us go into nighttime mode. Also, we need to change our devices. Our devices generate a lot of blue. So we need to put them into nighttime mode so we too can enter into nighttime mode. So this is how we can live healthily underneath the lights. Now, I hope that in this examination of how the unintended consequences that come arise from the light bulb, that you see the importance of examining technologies, and it's important to put technologies, even old ones, underneath the microscope. And this is what I do in The Alchemy of Us. And I hope that in this short presentation today that you can see that we create this technology, and this technology recreates us. But most importantly, I hope that you come away with the desire to examine technologies, modern technologies, and old ones too. As I say in my parting thought in The Alchemy of Us, I say the following. Such a thoughtful analysis of the impact of inventions benefits society, not just because it's an entertaining cerebral exercise, but because when coupled with action and social change, it has the potential to help society transcend its condition and favorably further this alchemy of us.
Wow, there's a lot of stuff there, Anise. You're listening to Cambridge Forum as we continue discussing the alchemy of us, how humans and matter transformed one another, with material scientist and author Anise Ramirez. Okay, so you say it's important to get people excited about science, but aren't we walking gadgetries with all our cell phones and our little devices already? Aren't we ads for science?
Well, I think it's important for us to know more science, even more so because we're surrounded by all these gadgets. And I'm saying we need to know more science, not because I want people to be scientists. I want them to be involved and see the world in a newer way. The gadgets that we have, the cell phones, they are not neutral entities. It took scientists to make them, but these materials also come from different places in the world. Some of these places are actually under a severe conflict. If we adopt some of the habits that scientists have, which is to think critically about things, then, well, maybe this can be something that we also discuss besides thinking about new features from our phone, but consider where are the materials coming from to make the phone. So that's what I'm really looking for. I'm not looking for people to go out and make new contraptions. I want them to just be more engaged. And one of the skills that scientists have is that we ask questions.
So you've certainly been asking a lot of questions all your life. So you're a young, gifted female Black scientist. Growing up, what was your role model? Was there a role model for you? And has the playing field in that regard changed?
I actually say this in The Alchemy of Us about my own origin story. I wanted to be a scientist since I was very young. I'm not sure where I got the idea from. But what sealed the deal for me is that I saw this public television program called 321 Contact. It had a reoccurring series called the Bloodhound Gang. And in it was an African-American girl solving mysteries and problems. And when I saw her, I saw my reflection. This is happening in the 80s. I didn't see many people that looked like me on TV doing positive things. And when I asked my mother, you know, what is she doing? My mom said, she's doing science. And I said, well, that's what I'm going to do. And that just kind of sealed the deal. And as for mentors, I feel fortunate because my path was really, has bits of light. And those bits of light were teachers who were like beacons that I said, well, I just want to go in that direction. They served like my North Star. They couldn't solve all my problems. There was definitely a lot of hardships of being the first, the only, and different for many different reasons, but they could at least give me proof that it was possible. And that's the importance of having mentors, just to see your reflection. They won't make it easy for you, but they will tell you that you can do it.
What other things? Somebody has actually just typed in a question here. Catherine Earle says, what's your most alarming insight into a particular technology we're using today?
Well, that's the final chapter of The Alchemy of Us, and that's computers. And that chapter is called Think. And I couldn't think of anything more human than our ability to think and to create, which is what that chapter is about. And I talk about how those things, to me, feel like they're under attack. By offsetting all of our information onto the web and using that as an external hard drive, when we create, we actually absorb the world, we let it simmer, and then we do something with it. But now we have a new relationship to information that we don't need to know. Oh, I'll just look that up later. Oh, I don't remember. And how do you create when you don't have the pieces to put things together in a new way? So I really feel that the way that we are, our relationship with information is under attack. And I talk about that in the last chapter of The Alchemy of Us, have how thinking is being modified by computers.
This has often bothered me. I mean, you refer to this shallows as you talk about it. And I've often been concerned about this, that we've, instead of using these tools, we've somehow become enslaved by them. Nobody looks anything up in a book anymore. God forbid that they even have books in the house. And those critical and analytical skills that are so important when you're discovering and you're curious and you want to get to the answer, they're being lost. Language is the next thing after the telegraph, which...
Right. Well, I think books help. Books definitely help. And the reason why I wrote The Alchemy of Us, it's actually a stealth way to exercise that muscle for thinking about things critically. You know, we have a lot of books that talk about technology, future technologies, AI, driverless cars, and we should be thinking critically about it. But many people don't feel like they can because they're just so distant. They're so foreign. It requires a sophistication of knowledge that most people don't have. I don't know a lot about driverless cars, but I know to be critical of them. But I wrote the book because it's about old technologies, simple technologies that people will think are something they can understand. A telegraph is just dots and dashes. A light bulb is heating up a wire. And I'm showing how those technologies shaped us. So if we can look at the past and exercise that muscle for being critical, we're better prepared to look at technologies in the future. So I think books and analysis of old things, of looking at history, is very important to prepare us for the future. It seems odd, but the history has so many lessons to prepare us for the future.
Would you mind talking about sleep and how even the light bulb has already affected that? I mean, the cell phone has definitely affected sleep patterns, but perhaps people don't know about how our sleep patterns are shaped by the light
bulb. I actually talk about in The Alchemy of Us in the first chapter about how we used to sleep differently. Before the Industrial Revolution, we used to sleep in two segments, both 3.5 hours. So we turn in around 9 o'clock, sleep for about 3.5 hours, then wake up for about an hour and do things around the house, sew, read, and then go back to sleep for 3.5 hours. And everybody slept this way, all throughout the Western cultures. Now, what happened? How did sleep get changed? Well, two things, the light bulb and the clock. The clock was that we had to go to bed, we had to wake up at a certain time in order to go to the factory. So one of the segments got truncated. And the light bulb was that we went to bed earlier because we wanted to do more in the evening. And so the second got truncated. And then eventually these two overlapped, they became consolidated, and it resembles the type of sleep that we have today. Now, researchers have done studies to see if this type of sleeping, this segmented sleep, is the natural way of sleeping. And they've done studies on people where they put them into dark rooms for 14 hours. They let them sleep off their sleep debt because they were completely exhausted. And guess what? They reverted back to this segmented sleep where they were sleeping for a couple of hours. They were in a drowsy state for about an hour or so, and then they went back to sleep. So there's a lot of thinking that this may be the normal form of sleeping. Also, when people talk about insomnia and a whole range of other sleep issues, some historians think that this may actually be an echo to segmented sleep. Many more studies need to be done. I talk about that in The Alchemy of Us, but sleep is one of the things that's been affected by our technologies.
Okay, talk about language for a second. You said how our language has been affected by technology. So Right. Is not this yet another cause for concern that we're all tweeting? Some of us spell better than others, and no one mentioned there, but is this not just yet another way of us dumbing down and losing our humanity, our ability to actually emote?
Well, first off, there's many factors that have shaped American language. One of them is that America wanted to individuate itself from the UK, and one of the ways they did that was the way that they use language. So the US, we have a more informal style of speaking, very sparse, more melodious on the UK side of the pond. So that was like a deliberate cultural change. As for language shaping and shifting, linguists are actually not too afraid of that. They say that that's what happens because language is actually living. You know, if you look at old archaic words that we don't use anymore, well, what happened? Well, we don't, you know, language shifts. We shed skin just like a snake. But what linguists are worried about is that because we've limited our communication to just really cool GIFs and text and emoticons, that we're really not picking up on the other ways that we communicate, which is to look at someone's eyes, to see if they are hesitant or if they're bored. We get visual cues. And as a result, if we don't exercise that muscle, we lose the ability to empathize. So that's the thing that is a little bit more scary than the shape of language. There are words that are going to change and grow, which is exciting. Language is a living thing. That's exciting. But the human skill of communicating in many other different ways, that's being lost. So that's the thing we should be concerned about.
You raised some interesting points. You like this relationship between the arts and science, which I love too, this like tango that they do. And you were talking in your TED talk about how screenwriting and science discovery have parallels. Can you elaborate a bit more about that?
Yeah, a couple of years ago, probably more than a couple of years ago, I had an opportunity to work with the American Film Institute, and I was paired with with a screenwriter. And we were tasked with writing a film which had accurate science in it. And as I was working with the screenwriter, I noticed that she had the same skills or the same things that I was interested in. She was a fanatic about details. She knew about iteration and rehearsal and the ability to trial and make errors. So I just saw these parallels. We often think of science having these skills, but it ends up the arts require them too. In order for things to be authentic, even if it is fiction, you must go through many cycles and test and probe to make sure that it comes off and it's accurate or rather it's authentic to the feeling that you're trying to encapsulate. So I really thought that was important. But also in thinking about the future, science thinks 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. But the arts can go way out to 30 years, show us what life looks like, and then inform science, hey, you need to be careful about this because in my thought experiment, I saw that this was a possible problem and we want to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I think the better scientists know that this is how we make better products and this is how we make a better world by getting information from many different aspects. So that's what I talk about in The Alchemy of Us.
Considering the implications, I think that's the important thing of injecting humanity into a scientific situation where you have a moral dilemma. The morality of a lot of these things is terribly important. When we're looking at conventions, yes, we can do this, but should we do it?
Such a good question. It's such a good question. You know, as a person who was a scientist, you're so geeked out on the new phenomena that you've figured out. you're also distracted with raising funds and guiding graduate students, that sometimes you forget to ask the question, is this a good idea? That's why we need the arts to say, you know what, this driverless car thing that you're working on sounds fantastic, but there's some ethical decisions that are being made in there, and you're not an ethicist. Is this a good idea? I think you should be talking to a philosopher or someone who can help you make better decisions. And what I'm talking about specifically is that when a driverless car is in a situation where there's an accident, a potential accident, it has to make a decision of who it's going to harm. And, you know, people who make code, they're great folks, but should they be making these decisions? No, I don't think so. I think they should be getting some information from the humanities. So we're totally on board. I think that the arts can illuminate this, because scientists may not be thinking that this is what they're doing. They're like, well, look, I just made this really cool technology. Isn't this great? Where they're not thinking that this technology is actually now going to be making decisions that impact human lives, and maybe not in the way that they would want to be affiliated with.
So you raise a lot of good points, particularly at this time, because the COVID crisis, everybody wants to do all things possible and go down all possible avenues. And then I've been reading some quite disturbing reports about the tracing aspect of using one's phone as a methodology, which of course they've been doing for a long time in China, for tracking people. And yes, it might be helpful. It might be helpful in seeing who this person's been in contact with. But do we want to surrender all our personal information, which can then be used for all sorts of other reasons?
That's right. That's right. It's always shown for one reason, but it's actually got many other reasons that are involved. And we have to be careful. So that's the reason why I wrote The Alchemy of Us, so that people would be more critical. You know, I talk about privacy. You know, here we are listening to our music, and this is initially how they were tracking data when we were just listening to music. But now they know who you are, who you're with, and all you're doing is you're listening to music. You're just you're focusing on the music part, but not knowing that your information is being sent to all these different places. So yeah, the intention of tracking for mitigation of the disease is certainly sound and important, but the rest of it, the door that opens, we may not be happy with. So, you know, this is the cost of technology. We gain something, we give away something too. And what I'm saying is that we need to be aware of that so we can push back whenever possible.
So science can't be taken out of context. It's got to be hooked into all the other social and political and cultural implications.
Science is a cultural force. It's not neutral. It is an actor. It comes from humans. So it's going to have all the traits that humans have. All of our errors, all of our flaws, all of our shortcomings are in the technology and the system that it's made in, the political system, that also is in our technologies too. So we have to not think of it as neutral and it's all good. That's not true. We have to be critical of it.
So, well, we like to thank the brilliantly shiny intellectual who had sparks flying off his synapses today, Anissa Ramirez. Her book is The Alchemy of Us. MIT Press, I think.
MIT Press, yep.
Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Harvard Bookstore, and lots of good programs in the pipeline. So don't forget to check the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thanks for your support and see you soon. So goodbye.